Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Peggy Sullivan. I'm moderator of this panel program. And in the program booklet, it appears as The Fabulous 50s, The Best is Yet to Come. And since we're also history-oriented, lest you think that referred to the 1950s, let me assure you it applies to our own 50s, and is related to people who are either being forced to consider or are happily considering, or maybe both, changes in their careers and in their orientations during their 50s. And for just a moment or two, I'd like to mention some of the things that, just to remind us all, I know that we're probably aware of them, the kinds of things that occur. Very often there are changes in the institution where one is, which may be budgetary changes, may be personnel changes, notably of directors and others who make decisions, even presidents of universities or directors of foundations, et cetera. And those changes occur, and other changes occur as a result on down through the system. For several years, when I've been talking to groups, recently one was a group of graduates from a library school here in the area, Dominican University, and I referred to the fact that there would be opportunities for them. You know, there's a point where they don't believe there will be. And I said, you know, the baby boomers are retiring. We hear a lot about that. And several of them came up to me afterwards and said, you know, we are baby boomers. We came to library school for our second or our third professional change. And among the things I think about that is that while that's probably no more common than it used to be, it's a much more accepted thing to reply, as is the fact that many people now feel much more comfortable to say, I am not going to make that change because I'm happy where I am, I'm happy with my family situation, etc. And I didn't say much about myself, but I'm revealing it, I guess, bit by bit, because I've also worked as an executive searcher, primarily for public library administrators, working with public library boards. And in my interviews there, I always say, you know, it's up to me to help you find the people who don't know they want another job. That there are the perennial ones who apply lavishly sometimes, but the people who don't know that they want to change are the people that I look after. And I think that there's more acceptance, as I do that, than there used to be of the fact that people may say, I have no wish to move at this time or for the foreseeable future. I have a few people who are sort of friends who have said to me, you know, don't call me till 2010. And they maybe said that several years ago, so I had several years to go on that at that time. And of course, I mentioned budgetary, but that relates to the whole economic situation and changes that may occur there in the economy at large about housing, et cetera, that affect people and positions. But we have, a wonderful panel, and to be on, I will make it clear that I am a librarian, not an archivist. And some of you may have been present this morning when Michael Gorman spoke at a program, and I'm not going to elaborate on this, but he described librarians as being like the Catholics, if you see this as a religious thing of information organization, and archivists being more like Protestants, that is freer, less concerned with ritual, etc. And for myself, because I am new to your community, I came yesterday to get a little better acquainted, and I, you know, I'm being distracted by the fact that they're lowering a potty over the Ferris wheel, which is something you don't always get to see in Chicago. But it's visible. A porta potty is being lowered. Yes, that's right. Yeah, right. Well, if the spirit moves you and you're on the Ferris wheel, what else are you going to do? I don't think it's for that purpose, but it was distracting for a moment. But for myself, after I was here yesterday, it may have been just the encounters I had, but I encountered a number of people. I heard more negatives about librarians yesterday than I probably have heard in, 2 years maybe. And I was writing a note to a friend this morning for her birthday, and I did say, and it, you know, I'm going back again today, and it is sort of like going to a land where you discover that the guys in the white hats are the bad guys. And that was what it, but, you know, I can overcome that, and I don't really believe that, so I'm delighted to be back with you again today. And I think next thing I want to do is to introduce our panelists and also alert you to the fact that after we had all been invited to do this, I was very slow in getting in touch with them, and I think a couple of them had planned probably to give more formal presentations. But we are going to approach this, I think, more with questions and back and forth and still have the opportunity for them to tell some of their stories. They are, beginning right here at my closest left, Cheryl Williams, and I realize many of you may know her already because she is on the Society of American Archivists Council, among many other responsibilities. She's the curator of the Kansas Collection at the University of Kansas, and the, I'm reading these titles to be sure I get them right, I hope, the interim head of the Spencer Library Archival Manuscript and Special Collections Repository, the Spencer Library being the library at the University of Kansas in Lawrence. And next to her, just back from the International Federation of Library Associations Conference in Durban, South Africa, is Carolyn Hoover Sung. And Carolyn is chief of the Network Division of the Library of Congress, the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, and has been in that position, well, I guess you haven't been in that position since 1995. Oh, you have? Okay, wonderful.
Come November.
And to just give you a few of the statistics she's given me, she has coordinated a cooperative nationwide network of 135 regional and sub-regional libraries that circulate over 23 million talking books, braille books, and magazines to a readership of more than 759,000. That was in 2006. I have, but I did not give Cheryl's background in education. I'll do that next, even though I missed it. But Carolyn's is that she has a baccalaureate Bachelor of Arts degree in history from Winthrop University, a Master of Arts in history from the University of Maryland, and a PhD in American Studies from George Washington University. Cheryl's, which I omitted, is a Bachelor of Arts degree in history from Kalamazoo College, a Master of Library Science from the University of Oklahoma. And then Dwayne Swanson, the farthest to my left, holds a Bachelor of Arts degree from Hamline University in Minnesota, a Master of Arts in American History from the University of Delaware. And while there, he was a Higbee Fellow, do I have that right? And that's the, I wanted to try the Eleutherian Mills Wendell-Hegley Foundation. And with a specialization in archival studies within the museum administration program, concentration in archival studies. I picked up archival this morning from the president's talk. I usually say archival. But since 1973, I think with some years before that, maybe part-time or something, he's been at the Minnesota Historical Society, where notably he directed a project to get the Great Northern Railroad records and has been a field representative to acquire government records, manuscript collections, etc. But since 2002 is the government records specialist in the collections management department and reference specialist in the reference department. So we see the range of people you have before you. And I'm going to ask them then, I think maybe the one way to start this would be to ask them to comment on why they think they're here. In other words, why did Elizabeth invite you? And I didn't acknowledge Elizabeth Whitman, who is our coordinator of programs. Is that what I could call you?
Yeah.
But initiator, thank you, Elizabeth. Yes, thank you. So maybe in telling why you're here, that would be a good part of your presentation. Thank you.
Well, I'll go first. As has already been explained, I'm from the University of Kansas, where I have been in my position since 1979. Yikes. A long time. And I, for many years at the University of Kansas as curator of the Kansas Collection and for a while as university archivist as well, was in charge of two departments within that building where there are three actual separate, there were three separate departments, Special Collections, Archives, and the Kansas Collection. And I loved my job, and I had my own staff as a department head. I was very happy with a middle management role. We did a lot of things within my department I was very proud of. We have developed an African-American collecting program in the state and the region. I had a lot of autonomy as a department head. The environment allowed us to do that. Within the building, we had some strained relationships because of different personalities between departments. But within the department, I felt that we were really strong, and I was really proud of what I was doing. I was very, very happy in my job, and that's why I stayed there for so long. About 7 or 8 years ago, we had a very not sudden but expected change. A few of the folks who were kind of considered the old guard were retiring, and it was time to take a fresh look at Spencer Library and see how we wanted to operate. And a former dean of the library and vice chancellor for the university chose to come and work as the head in Spencer Library, and we started looking at the deployment of our staff and realized that we needed to make some changes and had to combine the service desks in all three of our departments into a new department called Reader Services. This was something that intellectually I understood the need for, but personally impacted me in a way that made me very unhappy in my job. I didn't like change, and change came, as change always does, and I felt that I had less autonomy. I felt that I had I did not have the level of responsibility I had before. I went through a very difficult time where I really did not know if I could stay in my job. And I kept considering, what can I do? Can I, given my, you know, the age I was at, my family is all here. I don't really want to uproot them. Do I need to look for a different profession? I just really didn't know what to do, but I was very, very unhappy. And this went on for a while. I am pleased to say that I was able to work through that. I have chosen to stay at the University of Kansas, and I feel very happy about what I do today and was able to build on the positive aspects that that change brought. But I think that the experience that I had is something that, while personal to me, is worthwhile sharing, because I think a lot of people find themselves in positions where change is brought about, and even if you know intellectually in your head that it's the right thing, in your gut you may not know that. And it's very, very hard to reconcile that.
Good point. So. Thank you. Carolyn, would you like to?
I hate microphones. Can you hear me? I lost my voice in Durban, and I got it back a bit, but it still has a huskiness to it that's not normal. Well, I'm here for similar reasons. My whole career is at the Library of Congress. I came there in 1965, so I'm reflecting back on 50. I'm more than 50 now, but the big change came when I was in my 50s. And I had a horrible job at the Library of Congress, my first job, and we dreamed of the online catalog because we were working with the 3x5 cards and copying down the numbers so people could order the printed cards to file in their catalog. Oh, yes, those were horrible days. And then I got lucky and went to the manuscript division of the Library of Congress, which is a wonderful place, and that's how I got into archives. And I'm sort of this hybrid. I'm a librarian, archivist, and actually have more training for archives but more experience as a librarian. And so I worked over 15 years in the manuscript division, then got into management and worked for the library's photo duplication service. And some of you may have gotten to read the basic manual on reprography. What an awful word. And the first set of basic manuals of the Society of American Archivists, which I wrote. And so after that, I got into more management, because the library, as libraries in those days, tended to be organized around a research function or public service and the backside, you know, the technical service and acquisitions. And so I worked with that and preservation. I was actually head of the library. I was director of preservation for a whole year. That was unexpected and quite a treat because, well, they had a fire. or they had a problem with the diethyl zinc deacidification, mass deacidification project. Something went very amiss, and so the person who was in charge had to fix it. And so I was sent over there to run preservation for a year. So I did that. By the end of that time, we had a new librarian. And that, of course, means that there's change. And so they had this thing called the MAP Committee. And in case you ever want to see the strangest organization chart that's ever been devised in American history, it's printed in the government manual about, U.S. federal government manual about, must be about 88. But it's quite crazy. And so we divided up again, the same, you know, different words, but the same sort of split between the front of the house and the back of the house. And then in 95, we had a person who was decided that, you know, they needed to change the organization again and to consolidate all the library functions and, in effect, make a national library within the library, and cut down on all that excessive administrative blah 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 and all of that. So they consolidated it, and I found myself. I worked for the head of the constituent service, which is the front of the house, the public service end. And so then we all got shuffled around. So I got not reorganized, because when you get reorganized, you have rights. But you get realigned, and you don't have rights. You just have influence over your future. And so I ended up being offered two positions. I thought I'd go back to the manuscript division. That had been the tradition with people who had been in the administration of the research library. It was David Mearns, who was very prominent in the Archibald MacLeish era and into the 50s. He went to back to the manuscript division after being at the heights of leadership in the Library of Congress. So they always said the manuscript division was where the old elephants went to die. So I was hoping to go home to my happy home. Well, other people have other ideas about where you should go. And so I was offered two jobs with a straight face. I was offered to be chief of the network division of the National Library Service for the Blind. And that had been in the organization structure, and I had worked with them for more than 6 or 7 years. Or I could be the chief of operations at the library's office in Rio de Janeiro, knowing Portuguese, not knowing the language. I figured the blind was a better bet. And it actually turned out to be quite wonderful. And I think that is introduction. I think later I'll get to give you some of my tips and the reason I came all the way to Chicago, even though I only got in at 6 a.m. on Monday morning after the longest flight of my life. But I did want to come and share with you, because I think it's important to talk about these things.
And I think we're going to find that Duane has very similar experiences. It's interesting to hear this, because I've heard a little from Duane in advance. Please.
Well, I'm very tempted to say ditto. I didn't know that. But after having been very comfortably ensconced in one position as essentially the chief acquisition person for the State Archives in Minnesota, and having that for 20 years, and sort of assuming that that would probably be where I would end up with my archival career, the institution ran into financial issues. and we knew that. All the staff knew that. Roughly a 20% shortfall that had to be made up very quickly. So there was a lot of staff buzz about, you know, how would this be handled? Okay, fine. That's not the point of this session. Suffice it to say that I was asked to appear at my boss's office one morning, asked to read a letter, single-space, full-page letter, very complimentary, basically saying my position was eliminated. And in the reorganization process, in the realignment process, I was going to be offered 2 half-time jobs, equaling 1 full-time job, obviously, in 2 separate departments, neither of which I was currently in. And could I please have my answer before the end of this 20 to 25-minute session? And if that sounds negative, it's not intended to be.
Give us the negative version.
No. Like I said, we knew changes were coming. I knew the position that I was in was somewhat vulnerable, so I had thought about these, thought about various options before anything was specifically stated, just in case. I did some fast thinking within those 20, 25 minutes, and basically said, fine, this looks good. I knew my 2 new bosses, I knew I would have no problem with them, or at least I thought I would have no problem with them. I haven't. And went forth from there. But as I look back on the last 5 years in this new alignment, it has been a tremendous success for me personally. I could get back to some of the outreach that I loved and couldn't do, to the genealogy that I loved and couldn't do. And in a coordinative capacity, working half-time reference, half-time collections management, provides sort of a unique perspective on the continuum that a good archives should have to function. So in all, it's been a very positive change for me, but I assume that that's basically why I'm sitting behind the table here.
Thank you. I had not thought ahead of time about how similar your stories might be. So it occurs to me that what I'd like to ask next is whether along the line you've encountered, perhaps among your colleagues or the people you've supervised, people who didn't make the same kinds of choices you did, who may have reinvented themselves, gone somewhere else, and whether you have a view on that or what your suggestion would be if someone came to you in a position similar to where you were but was determined to get out of it. Oh, you do look thoughtful. Well, would you like to start, Sherry?
Sure. Okay. I had a lot of people who worked under my supervision and worked with me who were also equally unhappy with things going on, others who were excited about some of the changes. So it was a real mixture. I didn't have anybody that chose to leave, but I definitely had people who were reassigned to different departments, and there was a lot of, for a while there was a lot of unhappiness. And I think that one of the hardest things, this doesn't exactly address your question, but one of the hardest things for me was to be in a leadership role and being unhappy myself, trying hard not to project that for the people that were reporting to me and having to endure some of the same things as well. I found that very challenging. And I would say probably didn't always do as well as I would like to have done. But if somebody were to come to me and be at that crossroads in that kind of situation, one of the pieces of advice that I would offer is, first of all, I think you have to give yourself time. You know, you can, and unlike, unfortunately, Duane, you didn't really have any time to make your decision. But I knew that I was unhappy. I had to go through really thinking carefully about the job and what it might be in the future, and I didn't know what it would be. So I had to let myself experience that and to just accept that I was going to be unhappy for a while until I figured this out. And that just takes time. Whenever you have change occurring like that, it's going to take time for you to work into your new job. And then the other piece of advice, and I don't want to monopolize the mic here, but the other piece of advice I would give is to say, think very carefully about what it is you really want to do, because that's what made me stay, is that what I love the most is working with potential donors, acquiring material for the collection. I'm really a field archivist at heart. And it was the one thing that if they had taken that out of my job, I probably would have left. But when I got through the whole transitioning, I realized that what I really loved to do and that was at the core of what I did was still what I was doing. And I thought, what's wrong with me? This is really what I want to do. So it was fine.
Thank you. Carolyn?
Well, the Library of Congress is a big place. And I guess when our realignment came, some of the people were shuffled off to a new place really quickly because they were the desirable people. And then what happened with myself and my boss, he was left in his office even longer than I was left to stay around. But we were in that wonderful building with the dome on Capitol Hill, and we were the successors of the reference department, which was organized in 1939. And so we still had archives. So what I got to do, while kind of, you know, cooling my heels and finding out what they were going to offer me or exactly what was going to happen, I really got to do archival work. I actually took all of those records and packed them and did lists and stuff like that. So it's very soothing. You know, if you've ever processed collections and done that kind of stuff and liked it, it was very soothing. So it really helped, you know, sort of clean out my head. But the point I was going to make about the library being a big place is the National Library Service for the Blind was in the Library of Congress. It was organized in 1931, so last year was celebrated 75 years. But in the late 60s, when the library was expanding and going out of space, they sent the blind out to what they called Taylor Street. And when I was in the intern program and went to Taylor Street with my group, they picked us up after the presentation, and there were gunshots all over the place, and it was not a safe neighborhood. So this place was 6 miles or so from the Library of Congress, and in a very bad neighborhood, not like being on Capitol Hill where you saw everybody dressed up to the nines. I mean, I've yet to walk to the corner on that building. We have parking on top, and we go down and through the building and go in that way. And so it's a very different environment. But the upside of that was like it was being in a different place. It was like going to another place because the interaction within the library with the National Library Service is really looks out to the nation and works with libraries in every state. And so its focus was different. So it was like leaving but not leaving. And so that was good. I do think that it might have been more difficult to stay closer.
My advice to my colleagues who were either not as comfortable or as fortunate as I turned out to be in this reorganization was to look for the positive, to be patient, and barring positive answers to that, there is life beyond the institution, whether we think of it as in that way or not. And ultimately, that's a personal decision that one has to make, and that's the advice that I shared with those who solicited mine. Part of that is based on one's belief system. Part of it is based on, in my case at least, I did not become an archivist for the sake of archives. I became an archivist to save Minnesota history, and there's basically one institution in the state that could do that, and that was the one that was that I was fortunate enough to be employed by. Call it a call, or whatever term you want to use, that had not gone away, and that gave me strength to work with those who were less encouraged as I was. What was most difficult for me during all of this, yes, I had jobs. I was employed. Some of my colleagues weren't. And some of them were more senior in the jobs that I was now doing as a half-time person. And that was difficult for me to deal with. And it was, I think, difficult for those colleagues who sometimes stayed around as more part-time or as temporary people, but were still employed by the institution, knowing that they would have been employed full-time if I had not been asked to do the jobs that I was asked to do.
I think something that is implicit in some of the things you've said, it's really kind of a two-pronged thing as I see it. One is that at a time of shifting and change, you look for the essentials in the institution where you are. As you've described, your commitment was to the preservation of Minnesota history. But you also look at the essentials in yourself. I think you referred to this, Sherry. You think of what do I really do best? What are my strengths? And in exploring them, you often find the answer to what's the right way for you. And for some people, that may be change beyond the institution. For others, it may be change within it. I have a question for you, Carolyn, that is a little different. You know, you described this organizational chart that was from hell, I guess I would say.
Yeah.
Well, did anybody notice? I mean, I've seen so many organizational charts in my lifetime, and I think, gosh, how would you know a really bad one? Because there are a lot of bad ones. You just elaborate.
How many have you seen with circles?
Pardon me?
With circles.
Oh, instead of
and circles. Oh, okay. You know, with circles and, you know, reporting here and reporting there, you know, with lines that indicated authority, but which really weren't authority.
Kind of vague.
It was, it was done by a consultant.
So that explains everything. Thank you. I had alerted the panel that we might have questions even as we go, because it occurs to me that sometimes you have these at a particular time and may not want to wait till the end. So if there are questions or comments that might burst further, we could take them now as well. Anyone? Maybe I misjudged. Okay. I think that one of the things that all of this relates to really is, that I want to see it related to, I guess, is the part that continuing education may play in some of your choices and in some of the things that happen internally in your institutions. Would you like to comment on that? Or Dwayne, you immediately gave a face, so that lets you go first.
Unfortunately, I should be more poker faced. Because my area had been very focused on acquisition of government records, and I was very comfortable in that, I did not have the training or the perceived by others training to be a collections cataloger or even a reference specialist. And yet, those were the positions that I found myself in. Frankly, without a lot of institutional funds to be retrained or reeducated. So it was a matter of negotiating what I felt comfortable to do versus what would not create problems for my colleagues who could do the official cataloging because they were trained to do that. I was not. So that was one of the big issues for me. And we could be retrained, but only so much because of the funds that were available. And the rest of it we had to work on ourselves.
And where would you say you are now in regard to that? As competent as they were then, or differently
because of the job responsibilities as they have evolved.
Thank you.
I still cannot do a lot of the official work in either department, but I can do other things.
Carolyn? Yeah.
Well, there was a wonderful man at the Library of Congress named John Finzi, and there was an old movie called The Garden of the Finzi Continis about a very rich family. Well, that was his family. And he had marvelous, marvelous Italian suits. He was the best dressed man I think I've ever known. And he gave me some very good advice because I was always kind of under the radar because I'm not an MLS librarian. I actually tried to be. When I was starting their library school at Maryland, I got admitted to the library school. And I was signed up, trying to sign up for two classes. And then there was a guy there named Mr. McDonough, who was a terrible, terrible man. He talked to me and said, "You're working full time and you're married and you want to go to library school. We're looking for full-time students in our library school, but I guess we have to take you." Well, he made me so angry, and my reader had been the chair of the history department, so I called Dr. Shannon, and I said, "I've been admitted to the graduate school at the University of Maryland, but they're being really nasty. Maybe I could just get a degree in history with a subfield, you know, in archives, and maybe take some courses in the library school, but maybe this MLS thing is not for me." So that's what happened. I never got an MLS, and John Finzi told me, "Get a PhD. Then they won't notice that you don't have an MLS." So every time we do these consultant reports when we visit the libraries around the country, and one of the questions about the management is, does the librarian have an MLS? And so every time I read that, I'm saying, but I don't. But I think, that's one of the problems with qualifications later on, after you've had all of this experience, and the MLS was 2 years. Why is it still reign supreme?
I was going to say the further irony of it always seems to me that so few people admit they learned anything in library school, and then they turn around and say, "But you got to go." And I've been, so I can.
It's an annual
yes.
I just wanted to point out that throughout the federal government, you can be a librarian without having a library degree.
Yes.
I know librarians are shocked, and ALA hates that idea, but that's for sure the case. And having an MLS degree at the Library of Congress doesn't really help you very much at all.
Actually, one of the things I did in preparation for this afternoon was go to the Career Center to see what descriptions were, and I noted that. And, of course, a lot of these, most of those there were archival positions anyway, so they're not necessarily related to the library. I mean, to library credentials, that would be an alternate with being a certificated archivist. Is that right? Credentialed archivist?
And
other options as well, I think, which is healthy, it seems to me. I must say I have been on several faculties of several library schools also, But I'm reminded that when I was at the University of Chicago as a faculty member, which was in the 70s, and they still had a graduate library school, that was a very bad time for placement, and I was dean of students and responsible for helping students with placement. And with many students, being rejected for a position was the first sort of professional or academic rejection they'd ever experienced. I mean, they'd always gotten A's, they'd always gotten scholarships, they'd always gotten fellowships. And I would explain to them, you know, well, one difference here is there's only one job. So while there were five fellowships and several people could get them, that's not true when you're looking at a job. But they said, but I came to the University of Chicago. So one time I spoke with another faculty member, wonderful Herman Fussler, and he was a graduate of that library school, as I was not, except my PhD is from there. But I said to him, Herman, you know, I'd like to get these students thinking that it isn't just something wonderful that goes with them the rest of their lives, that they have a library degree from here. Don't you think that after maybe 5 years that people have to be responsible on their own for what they do? And he said, well, make it 10. But, you know, I think he was saying the same kind of thing. You create yourself. I mean, that's what a lot of this is about anyway, I think, that what you end up with is what you've made of yourself. And I think you're certainly a living example, Carolyn, right? Sherry, did you want to comment on some of that? There is someone else.
Question.
Okay. I'm sorry. Can't see.
You might be answering my
question. Well, I doubt it. But I'll go ahead and then you ask your question. I was just going to say that for me, continuing education, I lost the part of my job that changed really was the direct supervision of people. But I continued to do other things that I had been doing, and so it wasn't having to learn a new skill there. But what was helpful to me, continuing education-wise, was because I was struggling so much with all of this change, was we had a retreat, we brought in consultants, we had, I went to more change workshops than I can possibly remember. I charted my river of change on a big, you know, the piece of paper on the wall with, a bunch of other people. Did it help? At the time, I didn't think it was really helping, but as I look back, I realized that I was learning about the change process, something I hadn't thought very much about in the past, and that was very helpful to me. And I know one thing in particular I took away was from one workshop was that there are valleys and peaks in this process, and I knew I was in the valley, and I didn't know when I was getting out of it, but I knew I was stuck down there. But that was described as very much a part of the process, and that it helped me to realize that something weird wasn't happening just to me. It's something that other people experience too, and that was very helpful.
Thank you. Right. I can't see you, but I see your striped sleeve.
Yeah.
I think just to repeat that, although I assume most people heard it, it's about how would you have sold yourself in regard to your skills, et cetera, if you had made the decision to leave? Is that capturing it? Thank you.
For me, I thought about that all the time, and I felt pretty frustrated at times about, well, how would I sell myself? I'm of an age now where I'm not going to look very attractive in the workforce out there, you know, trying to sell myself. And, you know, I talked with other people who had made career changes at this stage in their lives and kind of looked at what they had done and how they had managed. And I realized it could be done, but I knew it was going to be very hard to do. And, you know, I felt that perhaps I would need more training, more technology-oriented background for me to be able to compete very effectively in the workforce. So I ultimately didn't do it, but I didn't choose to not do it for those reasons. I didn't let those reasons overwhelm me, but there were times when it felt like, good grief, how can I? My husband and I would have this ongoing kind of like, well, just get out there, go out, you know, go out and see what you can find, go out and see what you can do. He was always pushing me and saying, you know, you can do this. You don't need to feel that you're over the hill and, you know, too old to be doing these things. But the reality was I did feel that way, and while I was feeling that way, it wasn't going to work very well.
That's kind of wonderful that you had that support from him, that he was more open to change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd like to add the main point that I traveled to Chicago to say, which is that, you know, restructuring RIFs, realignment, they're just a fact of life. And I think the great burden is the guilt or the feeling that somehow you deserved what happened to you or you made it happen to yourself. Take all that and wipe it away. I was very lucky to have lived through Graham Rudman, where you had to give 50 people their RIF notices on the day before New Year's Eve. I mean, that's a pretty bad situation. But a colleague of mine in HR's words always stayed with me to help me, and said that, you know, a RIF or a realignment, it's like cancer. It happens. It just comes down and happens to you. It's not anything you did, and you just have to deal with it. And I think the over-analysis of, you know, why what happened can really bog you down and take your momentum away from you. So I would urge you to understand that change happens, and just to think about the future, go forward, not spend a lot of time saying, you know, this happened to me. I think that's the most important thing I wanted to say today, is this is not your fault.
Thank you. I don't know that I like that cancer example so much, but you're saying maybe being hit by a truck would suit me better.
I like the cancer.
You like the cancer. Okay. Sherry.
I just wanted to follow, and I know we've got some hands in the air, too. I just want to follow up on that because I came here to say one thing, too, and it's very similar. It really dovetails very well with what you just said, and that is that, and, you know, I think it's important to say this. I had to come to a point where I realized that I am not my job. I am a person separate from my job. And, I mean, yeah, that sounds, you know, logical, but I guess I didn't believe that. I thought I was my job. And when my job changed, I took it so personally that I felt embarrassed. I felt humiliated. I felt angry. I felt, how could they? And it took a long time for me to realize I am not my job. I mean, I care very much about what I do, and I'm very passionate about it. But my job is what I do. It's not who I am. I am a person outside of that. And I knew that I did a good job with my job. And I knew that, and I needed to allow myself to recognize, just as you're saying, it's something that happens, there shouldn't be guilt or you know, making yourself feel bad because it happened because of something you did. It's exactly what you were saying.
Thank you. But I'd like to take some of the questions.
Hi.
Sorry.
I was just going to mention in passing in response to Lynn's question.
Could you stand up so we could hear you? Oh, you're beautiful.
Actually, you're against the light. I can't see anyway.
I was just going to say that there are some of us in the profession also in our 50s and some somewhat older will support that.
Thank you. I do want to repeat that to be sure it's in the record that you're proposing a program for 2008. On and the title is Moonlight Sail in the Driveway, about how you really made major changes in response to adversities.
How you take your skills as an archivist and re-envision what you can do with it.
Re-envisioning. Oh, that's a great term. Right. Okay,
that
thank
is.
You.
I'm going to write that down.
Making the most of the midlife crisis. Thank you. And then, it's your response.
Yeah, I have several points. First of all, there are relatively few senior-level positions that are being created in archives, the high-end positions versus the entry-level and intermediate ones. Mm-hmm. So the profession, yes, is still not able to create an apparatus for people to move up within the organization, mm-hmm. unless you work for a very large one. You mm-hmm. move up by, you know, increasing your income by moving to another position in another mm-hmm. state. The second thing is, when I earned my MLS many years ago, we were taught that it was a marketable degree. Don't think of just going into librarianship. You can become an information broker or a research associate or something. And my question is this. Has anyone tracked to any degree people who have left the archives profession because, let's say, they lost their jobs or they decided to change careers? And if so, what other careers did they go into?
Thank you. If I might just recap that, and maybe people will be thinking of it as I do. The first part of your comment was that you've noted that there aren't real career ladders within archival work within an institution or an agency, and they don't exist. So has anybody surveyed people or found people who created changes for themselves and use those same skills? And you referred, of course, to people having maybe master's of library science degrees or information management, but where did they go or what's happened to them? I'd like to respond to that briefly myself. One of the things having spent, I think, maybe 20 years of my career as a library educator, I've seen so many different attitudes about this among people. There are faculty members who feel that if students don't go into libraries, they have failed. And there are students who have never intended to go into libraries in the first place. And in fact, I was talking to one of my former students who's become a dear friend, and I said to her one time, "Well, do you ever feel bad about the fact that you never used your library degree by working in libraries?" And she said, "I've used my library degree every day of my life." And I was sort of ashamed because I thought I had discounted that. I mean, her point was, I learned not just skills, but attitudes, theories, et cetera, et cetera. She went on further for me. And I'm using those all the time. But the other part of it is, I've also seen library school administrators in sort of crazy positions because, like, for 5 years, people in the field, especially those near them, will be saying, "Why are you turning out so many people? We can't deal with them." And then there's a kind of slough, and then they say, "Where are those people going? We need them." You know, and it's like the library school's fault, whichever way that happens. That's not an answer to your question, but I think it's a part of this whole dynamic, really, and I'm trying to focus more on the archival part of it, but it can't be divided, really, from other aspects of the information profession. And people are sometimes surprised with what specializations they find in themselves later that may not have been their original intentions. And I would guess we have some people like that here. But is there anyone who'd like to respond to the point about, do we know much about people who leave work in archives and what becomes of them, or do they? I thought of something else while you were speaking. That is, when I went through the Career Center today, one of the things that sort of intrigued me, and I honestly don't remember, I might not say even if I did, but there was a listing of positions, and it said, for a larger institution, and it said, it seems to me, library positions at 35,000 and archival position, maybe one or two at 35 or 40,000. Then it said human resources position, 79,000. And I found myself thinking, why do people in human resources who deal with the people who do the real stuff make double the money? And I agree it may have been a more scope or something, but just on the face of it, it was pretty shocking to me. And I've been shocked a lot, and I've worked in institutions where crazy things happen, but that just seemed somewhere off kilter to me. But I think it's related to some of these questions. Yes, you have either a question or a comment.
Well, I don't know if it's a question or a comment.
Okay.
Maybe you should just be waiting for the U-turn workshop next year. some of the tenor of what I've heard already, or if anyone in the room has.
Well, I have a colleague. This is not somebody who works with me at KU. Before I was speaking about the people who were working directly with me. I have a close friend who chose to become a nun for a while, joined a convent. And, you know, it's probably not the... Probably not...
There's
I've had colleagues, too, who have gone to the museum field, who have kind of morphed from the archives area to the museum area. Also, colleagues who have chosen to go into teaching full-time as opposed to working on a daily basis in archives. Yes.
There's a question at the back by the window. That was the. And that's the report to which the president was referring this morning. Is that the same
mm-hmm,
one?
Mm-hmm.
And it's published?
Yes, it's an American archivist.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Back to you.
I just wanted to know whether we could. What about that?
Okay. I assume you're addressing that to the panel and saying, what are other options?
I don't mean to monopolize, but you've touched on a real hot button for me. Apart from what happened to me, specifically in my job, I come from a library environment where, under a former dean who thankfully is no longer with us, I mean, she's working somewhere else, but she's, she didn't die. But it didn't come out exactly right.
She's not in the convent.
And she's not the one in the convent. But she had this attitude, this philosophy, this theory that anybody who had been at our institution more than 5 years was old and no good. I mean, get out, move on, move over, let other people come in. She would only give responsibility to new, young librarians. In this, I'm now talking within the library field. And that's great to bring in their take on things and their enthusiasm, but they often were being given jobs that they were not yet ready for from a maturity standpoint. And I mean, it became so bad in our environment that you could not say, well, you know why that is? Because, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, I mean, I learned very early on, you do not say that in meetings, but it began to feel a great deal like age discrimination. And I have to say that there were many times when I thought, is this a lawsuit here? I mean, I used to look at the people that I worked with as, older folks, and I suddenly found that I became the old fogey, and, when did that happen? And I didn't know that, and I don't feel like that in my head. And then I realized maybe I was being unfair to the people that I used to think of as the old fogies. So that's another take on it, too.
Dwayne, I don't know that you had an opportunity to comment on these last couple of things, and maybe you have something to say.
My only comment would be that I do have a number of friends who have left the historical profession, if not specifically the archival profession, gone into their own private research businesses, and have done very well.
Mm-hmm.
It can be very trying, obviously,
right?
And not success isn't as guaranteed as a regular employment, obviously, but that is one opportunity that does periodically present itself.
Mm-hmm.
And in the way of this whole sort of general comment of reinventing oneself, if I can go back to one of my former responsibilities as being on a local school board, we had one of our best teachers who repeatedly would stand up and say, I must change teaching assignments every 6 years, or I become boring to my students. And so she would have a new grade, a new subject matter, a new something every 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how she maintained
herself,
mm-hmm. changed herself, and maintained her freshness and her viability to her students.
Mm-hmm.
Which I've never forgotten that I thought, wow, she's good. She's good, and that's why she's good.
And knows that.
You're
right. Thank you.
You're not the only one that has. We have a new director in our institution, and I've been there 7 years, and everybody who's been there over 5 years is considered the old guard. And he wants to turn over everybody, and I'm one of the people who's threatened. My position is threatened because I'm from the old executive director.
Mm-hmm.
So even I went through a period a couple years ago where I was looking every day for a new job because the new director was looking to get rid of, sweep us all out of house.
Mm-hmm. What one of the
well,
things?
Well, then what happened?
Yeah.
And then what happened?
Yes.
Now we're at a stalemate.
Oh.
I'm just hoping. I know he has to retire when he's 65.
That was what I was going to ask. That's what we did. We waited out. We had tenure. I had tenure, but.
I have 7 more years to go. I'm counting down. I can make it. I just have to hold my tongue for 7 more years.
Oh.
It's a long time to hold your tongue.
That's what we all are doing.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Goodness, that seems really dreadful to me, but you know, the other part, and I thought I should have thought of it earlier, is that the whole process of job searching is very energy consuming as well. I mean, it's enlightening in a way when you review your credentials, et cetera, or have opportunities for interviews, get different perspectives. But I have, a former student who probably has applied for, I would start to say, more positions than exist, but that would be an exaggeration, but for lots and lots. And I just know that has to take energy away from his work.
In the meantime, I'm going back to Dominican for my MLS.
I see.
If I can get another job in the meantime.
You're ahead of the game. Well, I hope you don't hold your tongue for 7 years. Mm-hmm. That's personal. Is somebody over here? Okay.
Do you mean by
continuing education or consulting work?
Continuing education. Change is something that is, as you've all discovered and we all know, as a fact of life, and it's something that doesn't happen immediately, happens all the time. So are they giving the tools and providing the resources so individuals can better manage that? Because really, change is something that needs to be managed, not necessarily reacted.
One of the things that we did at the end of the mid to the end of constituent services, which was in the early 90s, was within our department, and that may have been, you know, some of our problem, that we instituted consultative management and sent all the staff through this training and got them involved at looking at issues and really looking at change. And for people who are old-style managers and are very authoritarian, are very threatened by that. And that was one, I think that was one of the things that that really led to the consolidation of these two departments. It's made a organization that is totally unworkable, and my view is pretty much failed. In terms of being able to be managed effectively when you have, 3,000 people in one department with one person trying to do the whole thing. And so I think that that the consultative management and so forth helped us in our moving on and in our receptivity to change. But it may have been inadvertently one of the things that undermined when my boss, whose job was abolished in this reorganization, when he retired and they had a party for him in one of the big rooms of the, it's a big exhibit hall in the front of the building with the dome. People gave him such a standing ovation. It was amazing. The librarian and the person who had instigated this change were standing there with their mouths wide open, and you know, people yelled out, "We love you," and stuff like that. So in a sense, we helped ourselves and we helped our people, so I think that any of these kinds of things that give a person a chance to take more control of their life and their work life is very empowering and very helpful when you're faced with this kind of situation and people are bearing down on you.
Just to follow up, then considering that, did they make steps to try to change or adjust or tweak the institutional culture?
You mean after the...
No, I think it really has gone into a total old-style authoritarian structure.
So it sounds like then they didn't really manage for change. You still
had no. Yeah. Yeah, so we're waiting for the next librarian.
Are you all holding your tongues?
No.
Doesn't sound like it, right? Okay. Duane?
I think very specifically, our institution has tried to put funds, limited though they may be, toward that sort of retraining, but that's a very expensive option. And when the institution was faced with a fair number of layoffs, I have to believe it was consciously decided that those people needed training and assistance more than the ones who remained. And a lot of funds were diverted to that sort of training. And I heard from numerous people who were laid off about how wonderful the services were in that very negative time. And I think that's it's a balance. It's a cost figure, a cost problem. And I think that certainly in our instance, the institution has tried.
I'm sorry, the final thing you said was the institution...
Our institution has tried.
Has tried, okay.
Yes.
Maybe some of the rest of you have had experiences similar to that that have worked out well. Do you want to comment? I'm thinking other people might have reactions to what you asked.
Over here,
or do you? Or something else?
No, I have a question.
Okay, well, let's go to that.
I work at a science research lab where a great number of people are over 50. Early retire them, or just get rid of them. So there are a couple things that are going on that are pretty demoralizing. Emeritus, but they don't stop working.
Absolutely, it's a trend. And the more money you make, the more vulnerable you are in these situations. And what we also find as budgets are not growing is that you don't want staff that have rights. You want to have consultants. You want to have temps. You want to give people as few rights as possible. It's a very, very definite trend. And it's I don't see how it's going to change.
I would like to comment myself though that I think it's not a new trend. I mean, this whole thing about very senior people with what appears to others to be very large salaries those don't always appear to them to be large salaries. You know, that's one part of it, but to me that's been true. Throughout my career, at least.
Oh, no, it's much worse.
Well, they're living longer.
Because...
I mean, but
there have been all of these buyouts. I mean, you know, there's been, for example, with the federal government, I'm sure it's true in state governments, they try to reduce the workforce as possible. You know, they point to the numbers of federal employees. I mean, it's a big political issue.
That
I understand. And then you have the new managers, like some of these directors I've heard mentioned in the group. And these individuals, it just sort of breaks your heart when you've seen people grow and change and contribute to an institution over the years. And say, well, we want to get new people that are creative, or we want to change it over to consultants. We want to change it to non-personal. We want to do it with the machine. And especially when you have a staff that if you invested in training, you could get a lot more out of them than you can out of this other tactic. Now, some people have been hoisted on their petard about that tactic. It's one thing to have your money in people, and then you have a RIF, and those people have friends, and they have congressmen, they have representatives, they have connections, they squeal, they make noise, and sometimes they back off. But if it's just a lump of money, they just take it. And it's gone. And that's one of the things that's happened is that with the rescissions of last year, the Library of Congress lost a huge, millions and millions from their digital effort, more than $10 million, because they didn't spend it, and it was in a lump of money, and they just took it. If it had been in people, it would have been much harder to take.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, okay.
I would like to respond. I heard you say that the younger people that work there tend to look at others in your age bracket as the short-timers, and like you're just hanging on to get more money, and that how hurtful that is to you. And I can well understand that. And I know I didn't quite have the same situation at my university, but we certainly, you know, had a lot of difference in approach in our whole library environment. And I think that one of the things that has helped me personally is we have a diversity committee, and I decided to get on the diversity committee. And one of the things I started pushing was having some library-wide discussions about different generations in the workplace. Now, granted, these programs weren't attended by as many people as I wish would have attended, but the ones that did, we had a very, very productive dialogue. And I think it opened everybody's eyes. It helps to get people of different generations together and talk about, because they may be totally unaware that is having that kind of effect on you. And your values and their values are probably different in terms of your work environment and culture. And sometimes just sharing that, if there was any way, I don't know in your environment if you can do that, but if there's any way to try to start facilitating that discussion, I think it really helps. It's just been my experience.
Yeah, that is an interesting point. Dwayne, were you ready to comment a few minutes? I thought you were moving. Okay. Are there other?
These are great people.
I was going to suggest we have a support group.
Well, you know, you remind me of something else, Elizabeth, by saying that. I think that another way that people can sort of reinvent themselves is by moving into other areas while retaining their positions, like maybe becoming more active professionally in associations or in maybe even community groups. You mentioned being on the school board, Dwayne. That's an outreach of a different kind. I was reminded, it was with a few minutes ago, with something someone said, it was when they referred to why that some people do leave. I remember that, and I know the date, in 1976, I was on the faculty, as I mentioned, at the University of Chicago in the library school, and I was invited by the chair of the nominating committee of the American Library Association to run for president. And it was a very busy time for me, and she kept sort of following me around and said, Peggy, I really want to talk with you. I want to talk with you. And finally I said, okay, let's talk. And she said, couldn't we sit down? I said, well, there's no place to sit here. So this was at an ALA conference, and I'm stressing the fact that it appeared to be impromptu, but it really wasn't. And she said, well, we wonder if you'd like to run for president of the American Library Association. I said, Rose, I have a boss who wonders where I am when I go to the bathroom. I can't run for ALA president because he'd notice I wasn't there. And then after that, so I really did turn her down. Now, it was fortunate for me that I had an opportunity and did run and did win several years later. But after that, I thought to myself, do I really have to put up with this? I mean, this is true that he would say, well, I noticed you weren't here till 5 o'clock yesterday. I'd say, well, that's because I had a class at 4:30. I mean, I taught a class at 4:30, so I was absent from 4:30 to 5. You know, it's just kind of weird things. And I know he wasn't trying to get rid of me because he appeared to be devastated when I left. But I thought, I don't have to do this. I mean, there really are things in yourself that speak to you if you listen about what to do. Oh, that got some hands, I guess. Yeah. Yes.
I think lateral growth in one's profession is so important as we advance because the opportunities to get to the top just are not there.
So find your satisfactions in other places if there aren't opportunities.
And the other thing is, I think, I don't know, do I speak for a lot of people? I went into the profession with the expectation once an archivist, always an archivist. And we have to provide, you know, mobility within the profession for the younger ones to move up. And I still don't see that.
I'd like to rephrase that question and really ask people for a show of hands. You're saying, are there people who came into the archival profession expecting there to be opportunities to move on some kind of career ladder within it, and have you been disappointed? Is that capturing it?
I'm speaking more for the profession. I'm sort of compiling in my head an open letter that I'm going to write one day.
I don't have a CA, and I don't have a but if I have two out of three, maybe they'll look at me.
I'm sure I can't capture that all, but I'm interested in your point that within the four-year period that you were away from work in archives, you also believe there was a change in what people saw as requirements, and that that included a Master of Library Science, what didn't used to be true? I saw some of those. Yeah.
Thank you. Which makes a lot of sense.
Sure. Right. You know, something that we haven't touched on that I think relates to this is the question of the description of people who are place-bound, because it occurs to me that if you're doing consulting that require access to archives, you need some real access to archives in addition to what might be available electronically. Have you resolved that question, or does that affect you? Oh, so you have that access. That's a different problem. Okay. Thank you. I think there are two questions.
A gentleman and a third
row. Someone up front, I thought. Right, you. Please.
Just a comment on the listserv, and you might be seeing that.
That's an interesting point, because I do think...
Yeah, and also seeing HRs that are doing the same thing. You know, they've got a shopping list. Very rigid one when they start out, and the trick is to get past that, you know, that first hurdle.
Right. So you're saying that the people in human resources become more limited in numbers and therefore may rely more on paper credentials, and I would add to that because that's easier to judge. I mean, it's harder to take two resumes.
Again, it's the collapse of the jobs, that there aren't jobs in this particular sector. I mean, in the Library of Congress for about, from Graham Rudman in 86 to about 94, 95, we hardly hired a professional. And it's very, very rare when an entry-level professional job comes up. It's just drying up.
And I'll second Carolyn's comment. Within our collections management department, archival processing unit, we are down 7 people from 5 years ago. Mm-hmm.
7 people down?
7
in one,
people,
is that right?
No. Out of 20. Mm. I think it was 20. Mm. And yet, our workload has increased.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yes, you had a question or a comment in the front. In the front.
I had a dad all over. Whether it's a difficult colleague or whether it's a plummeting budget or whether it's, you know, rifts, you know, right, left, and center, it's very encouraging. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I think that's a good note to end on. That's upbeat. I was going to say that before you got to the point about it's bad all over. So thank you. Thank you all. I surely see how your questions and comments have enriched the program. Thank you for that.